The first of all, let's keep to the protocol. Today is Monday, September 15th, 2014. It's a Monday morning in Yerushalayim HaKodesh. And I say good morning to my students in front of me and to the many more that are listening across the wide expanse of what's left of the universe. When the Arabs get done with it, who knows what's going to be left? That's a different story. Anyway, the story behind this is a very sad story. This is a Talmud who was raised in Brooklyn, raised in Borough Park. I don't want to mention the name, but it's from a very well-known right-wing Orthodox family. And they sent him to Tells. And he was in Tells. He graduated June of 67. Got it? And he went from the graduation to the airport to fly to Israel to join the Israeli army. And his rebbeim, I don't want to use a sharp word, but were very, very upset with him and let him feel he was a second-rate Jew going to serve in the Israeli army. Anyway, he served in the army. He served for a number of years for an American fellow to come to the IDF in 67 and go on to become a Rav Seren, a major, is an achievement. Then he married a girl from B'nai Brak, and he decided to go to America for 2 years to make a little money. Went to America, and the usual story, you go for 2 years, and you forget to come back. And he made a little money, and all his life he was furious and angry and upset and thwarted by Tells and their attitude towards Israel and the army and Zionism, etc., and very bitter, and within him there was love of Yiddishkeit and enmity. And then someone told him to hook on to a guy named Rakefet, and Baruch Hashem, we helped change his life, and he became very close. I loved him. Whenever he was in Israel, he would come to visit. When I was in America, But a number of years ago, after giving me this little gizmo and trying to teach me how to use it, he committed suicide. On Friday, Erev Shabbos, he evidently, with his business, was involved with the Israeli mafia. No one ever, this story never totally surfaced in Florida. And God have mercy, on Friday, kissed his wife twice that day. Not once, she said. She always wondered that morning. He kissed her twice before when he left. And left a note for his wife, left a note for his lawyer on Friday. So whenever I touch this, I shiver, I shake. Okay, also I want to mention to my students that daven here, feel free to come to class with breakfast, whatever you wish. Hashtia kedat eino neis. The main thing is we have to begin on time. Next, I want to learn names, so please write down your name. Those of you who are older don't have to go beyond that, but those of you who are younger, write down where you went to college, YC, TC is Touro College, etc. Smicha, what year, 2, 3, and after that, where you were raised. If you were raised in Teaneck, write down Teaneck. If you were raised in the Upper West Side, just write down Upper West Side, I'll understand. All right, we're ready to roll. The story with the presidency of the yeshiva, you see, Rabbi Young and Rabbi Lookstein were well-known rabbis, not just well-known rabbis. These were rabbis who had access to money. To become president of yeshiva, you needed money. Yeshiva depends upon money, fundraising. Ultimately, the presidency of yeshiva it turns into a glorified fundraiser. Rabbi Revel, when he first came to yeshiva, had the advantage that he was independently wealthy. His family, the Travis family, was well-to-do. He didn't take a penny from the yeshiva until the family started to go under due to unfair business practices by Standard Oil, by the Rockefeller family. And then Rabbi Revel went out to Tulsa, Oklahoma to try to help salvage the family interest in oil. And yeshiva pleaded with him to come back because without Rabbi Revel, the yeshiva was floundering. When Rabbi Revel came back in 22, that was the first time he took a salary. His salary read $10,000. He never took more than $4,000 a year. And when Reb Moshe Soloveitchik came to the yeshiva, Rabbi Revel cut his own salary to $3,600 and gave Reb Moshe $4,000. And when they asked Rabbi Revel, why do you cut your salary? You're the president, you're the Rosh Yeshiva, you're the head honcho, you're the head man. He said, Reb Moshe has 5 children, I only have 2. And he was a very devoted individual. By 1941, Yeshiva has a big budget. It's Yeshiva, it's Yeshiva College. Immigrants are pouring in. Remember, it's the World War II, what's happening in the late 30s, everything we spoke about last year. And Yeshiva needs heavy funding. And remember, these immigrants pouring in, it's not like the French immigration or Aliyah to the State of Israel today, where Baruch Hashem, it's overwhelming to see all the French, and these people are wealthy. These are not poor people. In my neighborhood in Jerusalem, what it has done to real estate is beyond comprehension. Every morning I get a note in my box that we want to buy an apartment, there's this building, cash on the line. All right, that's all fine and beautiful, but if I sell my apartment, cash on the line, where do I live? And I'm not exactly prepared at my age to go to Beth El, even though there I would have no problem carrying on Shabbos. That Erev, as we said yesterday, is L'chol HaDeyot. So you see, Rabbi Young and Rabbi Lookstein were both very prominent candidates. Rabbi Young represented the West Side money. Rabbi Lookstein represented the East Side money. So Rabbi Rubin asked me after class, how come Rabbi Goldstein was not mentioned? He was the third. There were the three giants of the rabbinate. I write about it in the Rav. I quote Mori Rebbe talking about the three giants of the rabbinate. The three giants of the rabbinate were Young, Lookstein, and Goldstein. But you see, Goldstein didn't control the money. The West Side Institutional was never on the level of KJ. KJ was the money congregation. The Jewish Center was the money congregation. Rabbi Goldstein had one access to money, which I don't want to minimize, and that, of course, was Harry Fischel. Harry Fischel was Rabbi Goldstein's father-in-law, and Harry Fischel was an absolute heavyweight, although after 29 in the recession, he was not the Harry Fischel before 29, could do anything he wanted. He could buy the Brooklyn Bridge if he wished. But after 29, I heard this from his family. It's not that he was a poor man. He was a multimillionaire, but he was a limited multimillionaire. There's a difference between someone like Adelson, Sheldon Adelson, who can do anything he wants. And you have other people on the yeshiva board of trustees give yeshiva $5 million a year. If Adelson wants, he can give yeshiva $100 million a year without batting an eyelash. Of course, he puts his money into Israel, and I'm not going to contradict him or criticize him for that, not at all. Sheldon Adelson might have saved the State of Israel from itself, plain and simple, if you know what I'm talking about. It'll come out in today's news as well when we hear what the Judge Noam Salzberg rules in relation to Omid and company. So this is why Rabbi Goldstein didn't fit into the picture. Nevertheless, Rabbi Lookstein does not have the scholarly credentials of Rabbi Young. And Rabbi Young was a scholar, was a PhD, was knowledgeable. Rabbi Young, the books that he edited, the books that he wrote, the articles that he wrote, you could go on and on describing Rabbi Young. So Rabbi Young versus Rabbi Soloveitchik, you have a Litvish Talmud Chacham versus a scholar of the German, Hungarian, English school. Chochmat Yisrael mixed with traditional learning. Who is the greatest scholar? Well, it depends on your vantage point. If you're coming in from a Litvisher point of view, Rabbi Young doesn't fit into the same breath with Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. If you're coming in from a Chochmat Yisrael, general overlook point of view, Rabbi Young already was publishing books, going into topics, the American rabbinate, the Jewish woman, the Jewish home, education. Rabbi Young, Palestine, Israel. He was on top of the ballpark. And these two men canceled each other out. Now, while this is happening, we come to one of the most amazing stories in the history of Torah in the United States, worthy of a movie. I hope that I have a student listening who will, I have a grandson who who will put out movies one day. But he's Israeli. His thrust is Israel, the Holocaust. He did a few-minute piece on his grandfather, 2 minutes. Masterful what a kid could do. And kol hakavod to the Mamlachti Dati school system that in high school already, a kid interested in movies, interested in music, interested in art, can find where to study and outlet for his talents. But I need someone who has a feeling for the history of Torah in America, and the story of Rabbi Belkin is beyond description. Now, when we come to Rabbi Belkin, we have a tremendous problem. There is very little material published about his life. Not only that, what is published, I'll show you on some of the main issues of his life, you have total contradiction. Rabbi Belkin never spoke about his life. His early years were years of horror, of heartache. I'll explain it in a moment. He never spoke about his life. He never, ever spoke or wrote. It's not like the Rav. What's interesting about the Rav, and let me talk about Moriah Rebbe for a minute or two, because he's going to be contrasted with Dr. Belkin Tyson, with Dr. Belkin. If not for the Rav, Dr. Belkin could not have become Dr. Belkin. It's fascinating how they complemented each other. The Hashgach of Pratit here, that worked out. But the Rav, very amazingly, the Rav was a very private individual. All of you know that, you've heard the stories. It wasn't like Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, Reb Shmuel Soloveitchik, my chemistry teacher. You could approach them, you could joke around with them, you could talk with them about anything. I mean, there was nothing under the sun. Vic knew Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. You know what I'm saying, Vic. He was Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, a gon shebagonim. On the other hand, he was one of the boys. Mamish, one of the boys. He was a fabulous individual. Shmuel Soloveitchik, chemistry professor, held two patents. You know, with Soloveitchik, a genius. We used to bother him after class about his family, and he would tell us stories. One time, I told you this, I think, last year, but I'll repeat it. I'm an ear witness to this. He got us into, he got the Soloveitchik family into a lot of trouble. Why? Because Reb Velvel, his world-famous uncle, Reb Velvel, came out, you know, the Soloveitchik split, hashkafa-wise. The Soloveitchiks who went to America became Mizrachiites, and the Soloveitchiks that came here became part of the Eder Charedet. How that happened, we'll leave that to future generations to figure out, but there's freedom of choice in this world. So one time Reb Velvel was fighting with the Mizrachi. I think I recall the incident, but it's not important. It involved Yitzchak Rafal, Yitzchak Rafal's son, Rabbi Shilo. I knew these people, Zichronom Levracha. And we said to Reb Shmuel, your uncle, what's with him? And he says, well, everyone knows my uncle's a bit eccentric, you know, everyone knows it. And the word went all over New York then. It wasn't like today, that YU sits in its own little world. In those days, the YU guy picked up the phone to Teira Vadas. Teira Vadas walked over to Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin guys told the guys in RJJ. Before you knew it, it wound up in Lakewood. And the world went crazy that the Rav criticized his uncle, Reb Velvel. And boy, the Rav was in Boston at the time. He had nothing to do with it. It was Shmuel Soloveitchik. But when the word went out of Soloveitchik criticized his uncle, everyone took for granted it was the Rav. Now, you all know the Rav's hesped on Reb Velvel is classic. On his uncle, it's classic. So the Rav may have agreed with Reb Shmuel, but I don't believe the Rav would have criticized his uncle in public. So the Rav was not like his brother. It was not like Reb Aaron. It was not like Reb Shmuel. The Rav, there was a fear. The Rav, you didn't, you know, as a kid, you were afraid. It took me many years to realize that all you had to do was break down the barrier in front of the Rav, and you could be very close to him. Of course, you had to know how to learn. The Rav, if you didn't know how to learn, the Rav viewed you a little bit differently. I don't want to say he had disrespect, but you had to know how to learn. You had to do it. It was an attitude of Balabas in Boston. I would believe Rabbi Rubin will agree, the Rav didn't view him. The Rav viewed him b'yava b'yira, b'shalom b'shalva. But the Rav viewed someone you had to know how to learn. A Talmud, I remember the Rav saying on Sidon, a Talmud Chacham from Chicago, for the Rav, and by someone my age. So I remember the Rav mentioned, it's a pleasure to speak with him and learning. He knows how to learn. And that was the Rav. But the Rav was a private person, right? The Rav, the lonely man of faith. They quote the Rav as saying, I have many people surrounding me, and I have many talmidim and many colleagues, and the Rav never walked to the subway alone. There were 10 of us around him, bothering him with questions, shooting questions at him. But he was lonely. He was lonely. What's amazing about the Rav, when he got up in public and spoke a tshuva drasha, a yahrzeit drasha, Sunday morning in Boston, Saturday night in Boston, he revealed his inner secrets in public. He could talk about his father, his mother, his wife, his children, his grandchildren, his inner secrets. The Rav taught me how to be a mensch, taught me how to be a husband, taught me how to be a father, taught me how to be a grandfather, taught me how to be a son. I picked up every time the Rav spoke about family, it was overwhelming. Those of you know Ahad Shiva, where he talks about his wife and his illness, and if he could only speak with her again, and it's overwhelming. And you should know, when the Ahad Shiva came out, the Israeli scene was shocked. Why? Because I came in Aliyah to an Israel where the Rabbanim, it may still go on until today, if it does go on until today, smack their faces and run, because you don't want to go to jail, but smack the faces. These Rabbanim walk around, you know, holier than anybody. What we spoke about yesterday, what Rav Menashe, we did yesterday, Shia, wow, we touched upon 2 points. Rav Menashe Klein, remember the second point, with being machmir, with Shmuel and Rav, you're the Yerushalmi, you're a zakein mamre, ad kedei kach, you walk around, I'm bigger than owner, don't even talk to me. You know the story I tell you with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, I'm an ear witness to it. This kid came to BMT in 1971, 72. Kid grew up in Crown Heights. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein grew up in Crown Heights. So this kid spent a Shabbos in Alon Shvut, and he was very happy, and Rabbi Aaron got, they were talking about the Crown Heights Yeshiva and some of the Rebbeim that Rabbi Aaron had, the kid had, and they were comparing notes. After Shabbos, the kid goes over to Rabbi Aaron, Shavua Tov, Rabbi Shavua Tov, Agutvach, and the elder Talmidim of Alon Shvut come over to this kid. Who the heck are you to talk with the Rosh Yeshiva? You're not allowed to approach the Rosh Yeshiva. You're a young schnook yet. And there was that attitude of distance. And when the Al HaTshuva came out with the personal revelations of the Rav speaking, you should have seen the Israeli press, the religious press. I still remember, wow, this is very strange. A Gadol B'Yisrael, the Gadol Hadar, the greatest Rosh Yeshiva, the greatest Mechadesh, revealed. But you see, that was interesting about the Rav. In private, there was a distance. He was distant from you. There was a world between you. He was a lonely person who hifnim et hakol. Everything was within him. And in public, he could reveal, my father never kissed me. All right, now you just think about that and the implications and what that means. My father never kissed me. What I learned from my mother, where the Rav goes on and on. My father taught me Hilchot Shabbos, but my mother taught me what Shabbat was about. And then he would describe his mother and Shabbat and her techinot and her saying Tehillim and her reading Russian literature and Matan Hebrew literature. It was unbelievable. Dr. Belkin you couldn't talk with him about his family publicly or privately. It never entered into the discussion. And this makes it very, very hard to talk about his life. Now, let me go one step further. Very important, what I'm going to tell you now. If someone here will work on a doctorate in Dr. Belkin, this will be important for you because it gives you a certain link. Vic Geller. Again, Vayakam Dachadash, so I mentioned the name Vic Geller, and Max Daniel is looking at me blankly. You never heard the name. Do you know who I'm talking about? No, a blank stare. But when I mentioned Kenny Brander, Rabbi Brander, that name you heard, oh, CJF, he heard his future depends upon him, his life, his job. Wow, even in this building with all the lack of money we have, but Rabbi Brander has a full staff working for him, and he has ability from Washington Heights. He gives directives and orders that are follow out here to the letter of the law. Now, Vic Geller was a yeshiva boy. He grew up in the Bronx in the 1930s into the early 40s. He came from a religious home. His mother was widowed at an early age. She raised him in the Bronx, the Mesirat Nefesh, the Mount Eaton Center area. If you come from the Bronx, you know what I'm talking about. That was the Jewish area. And he went to yeshiva. Then he served in World War II. And afterwards got a master's and very capable in community work. Very bright, insightful individual. He was the prime person in CSD, Community Service Division, which is the precursor, the forerunner to the Center for the Jewish Future. When I went into the rabbinate, it was Vic Geller that placed me, okay? And over the years, we interacted. He lives in Israel. He's not well today. He's in his 90s. Early 90s, but ill health overtakes you, and Vic should only be well. He struggles today, health-wise. Vic was one of the most insightful people I ever met. You'll see yourself how insightful he is. He had a very good friend, Sam Hartstein, who died recently, Zichrona Livracha. Does the name Sam Hartstein mean anything to you? Vayakam Dachadash. You see, the art scrolled world knows how to keep personalities alive. In our world, Rakefet is fighting a totally losing battle. But you see, Rakefet is smart enough to know he's losing. And being Rakefet, and having gone through what he went through in 61 due to Vic Geller placing him at Lower Merion Synagogue, he doesn't mind fighting a losing battle, underlined the word losing. It's part of life. The Rav taught us, learn how to lose. Man has to learn how to withdraw. Yitzchak, am I right or wrong? A basic message in the Rav's teachings. Very different than many other Rebbeim and how they would speak about conquering the world. Not the Rav. So there were three brothers who came out of yeshiva, Hartstein brothers, Shemesh Shabbos brothers. You got to remember this was rare in the 20s and the 30s. Who heard of Shmirat Shabbat? Who heard of parents raising from kids? Read my classmate, Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, Dr. Grach's magnum opus in philosophy or in sociology, Rupture and Reconstruction. And even though Professor Steiner and others attacked him, they were from people in America who remained from, 2%. But Chaim's talking about the other 98%. So the Hartstein brothers, one became a Rav. One became what you would call today the Dean of Yeshiva College. That was Jacob Hartstein. The youngest brother, Sam, who died now in his mid-90s, Sam built public relations of yeshiva. He was the genius who put yeshiva on the map, who got photographs into the New York Times, who got articles all over. Rabbi Belkin was very intimate with Sam Hartstein. And at times, he would let his hair down to Sam Hartstein. See, the Rav, too, had people that These were his intimate friends. They were not his colleagues. They were not on his level. But you'll take Manny Holzer in New York. You'll take Abe Levovitz, who moved to Boston to be near the Rav. Abe Levovitz, Eichet Tzadik Levracha. With them, the Rav, he was one of the boys. Dr. Belkin could confide in Sam Hartstein. They, since this magic feeling that two people, when the Rav talks about friendship, he quotes the Rambam in his Perish HaMishnayot on Pirkei Avot. I trust you're familiar with it. But these are friends, Lideya. They share the same understanding of life. They share the same experiences. Now, Vic Yeller was very close with Sam Hartstein. So you have Dr. Belkin close with Sam, and Sam and Vic, bosom buddies. So from Dr. Belkin, it filtered down to Vic Yeller. Now, Vic Yeller has a docile pen, and he wrote a number of books. He wrote about the family, about his own family, about his brother-in-law who died at a young age, about his army experiences. But then he wrote a book, Orthodoxy Awakens, The Belkin Era and Yeshiva University. That book I worked very hard to get published. It's a memoir. It's not a PhD. It's not a scholarly work in the sense with endless footnotes, with documentation, with painting a broad picture and then going into the individual you want to describe. It's a memoir. But it's a very fascinating memoir. And basically whatever we know about Dr. Belkin today is essentially in that memoir by Vic Yeller. Some of the material I knew, I helped, I got for Vic. Other material he got, he interviewed endless people, and a lot of material from Dr. afterwards, he got an honorary doctorate from Yeshiva when he retired, Sam Hartstein. Now, let's go into some of the facts that we hope are correct about Dr. Belkin's life. It's an amazing story. It's a Cinderella story, plain and simple. His years, first of all, 1911-1976. He was the youngest of 16 children. His father was a Rav. The family, 16 children, desperately poor and tremendous heartache. One evening, there was a knock on his father's door. This is in Poland, the part of Poland next to Lithuania. Father opens the door, and a policeman is standing there and says to his father, "You are a communist," and shoots him and kills him on the spot in front of his family. Mother is left with many children, some die in childhood, others die of tuberculosis. Others disappear in the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union takes over this area. Shmuel himself as a youngster was very sick for a while. Thank God he recovered. And at a young age, he goes to Slonim Yeshiva. Now, Slonim Yeshiva, there was someone else there whose name perhaps you still may recall was a Rebbe in YU for endless years, a fabulous individual, Rabbi Shimon Rum, R-O-M-M. Make believe you've heard the name, so the ignorant will pass for the wise. Yomo, you yet knew Reb Shimon? Okay, you didn't know. No, he died a number of years ago. He already died. He was in his early 90s. I knew him very well. And I would tell him off, I would tell off Reb Shimon Rum, so you wonder what the heck does Rakefet, the island, tell off Reb Shimon Rum, who the heck is Rakefet, who get? But Reb Shimon Rum was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He began in Slonim, afterwards winds up in Mir, tremendous Talmud Chacham, came to Israel after World War II, survived with miracles, Shalapi Yivrit, magnificent speaker, Mizrahi leader, what he would have become in Israel, the chief rabbi. And what an individual, what a personality. And Dr. Belkin brought him to America. And he winds up in America. I said, Rav Shimon, you wasted your life. You should have come in Aliyah. You should have been here in your 40s and your 50s and your 60s. You would have been a shtat rav. But all right, God at least agrees with Rakefet. All his children and grandchildren, without exception, all live al admat hakodesh. Rabbi Sosofsky is his son-in-law, if that name means anything to you. All right, what's his yeshiva called? Or Yerushalayim. OJ, I think they call it. OJ. That's the son-in-law. So now, Reb Shimon Rum and Reb Shmuel Belkin, two orphans, wind up in Slonim, poorer than church mice. And Reb Shimon revealed, Dr. Belkin never revealed this, never could speak about it. They were so poor, they had one bed. And they took turns. One night, one would sleep on the bed and one would sleep on the floor. Okay? One bed. They had one coat and one pair of shoes that they shared between them. So you see, Rakefet, let me smack his face. He had no right to rebuke Reb Shimon Rum. In America, he had an overcoat, he had a pair of shoes. He had a bed. Like, you follow me, Max? Life in Israel was harder. A melamed zchut. This is why I will never let anyone criticize Reb Shaul Liebman in my presence. You understand? I've had Rashi Yeshiva colleagues say, "What?" They foam at the mouth. Where he, I smack their faces. His first wife died. The Minsk Gadol's granddaughter was his first wife. We don't know until today. Rumor has it she died because he didn't have money to bring it to a doctor in Israel when she took ill. You understand what I'm saying? So, all right, Rakefet didn't succumb to money offers. I'm proud. I can boast. I was offered money in a tell you, American conservative rap. It doesn't matter. All right, but I'm not going to criticize others. You understand? No one knows, sitting in Washington Heights, what it means to starve. And here you see what it was like in slum. Now, the Belkin family, three members of the family made it to the Western Hemisphere. Dr. Belkin had an older sister, Rose Belkin, mechanic. It's interesting, I taught a mechanic in the 60s. I wonder if he wasn't a relation. At that time, I didn't know and knew about Rose Mechanic. She made it to Canada, and she settled in Ontario, Fort City. Anyone here from Canada? It's near Windsor. There were some Jews living there at the time. Another sister came to the United States, an older sister. She died in an automobile accident. So she could be of no help. The one who really became the key maker in Rabbi Belkin's early American life is Ida Sobel. Ida Sobel lived in Brooklyn. She already was a first cousin to Rabbi Belkin. The family had made a little money, and she was able to help him. He gets a visa to come to America. His cousin invites him. 1928, he lands in New York. The Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society meets him and sends him on to his first cousin in Brooklyn. From his first cousin, he goes to his sister. And about 6-7 months later, his cousin, Ida Sobel, arranges a visa for him to come back to the United States as a student. He comes back to Brooklyn, and he's now 1928-29. He's all of 17, 18 years old, a Goynisha cup, knows Shas and Paiskim backwards and forwards, a photographic memory. I can tell you, I became very close to Dr. Belkin, or as close as any student could become in the 1950s into the 60s, as close as any student could become. And that was just the min shemayim, fortuitous. It's not important now. You can ask me the next week how I knew Dr. Belkin so well, or better than any other student. So he comes back to Brooklyn, and he, you know, what does he do? Where does he turn? What does he do next? and he goes to Teira Vadas. Teira Vadas, with all due respects, what Teira Vadas is today, Torah Vadas was not yet what Rietz was at the time. Rietz, and you know I'm saying this as a historian, not trying to show off that I'm a New York Yankee fan, I'm a Rietz fan. But facts, Rietz already had the Maitre Te'iloi. Rietz already had Reb Shlomo Palachek, right? We spoke about him a week or two ago. Last week, I think we spoke about him. We spoke about him last year. Rietz already had something going. So Dr. Belkin, or Reb Shmuel Belkin, the young Samuel, was unhappy in Teira Vadas, and he headed uptown to Rietz. And in Rietz, he meets the individual who would become his lodestar, his not just the Rebbe, but the person who would direct his life. And that, of course, is Rabbi Dr. Bernard Raphael. The similarities between them were unbelievable. Rabbi Revel was a Litvisher like Reb Shmuel Belkin. Rabbi Revel had a photographic memory like Reb Shmuel Belkin. Rabbi Revel ran away from Europe in 1906, arrived in America. He was a bit older. He was 21 years old at the time, right? He was born in 1885, and he comes to America in 1906, 21 years old. And in America, he goes on to get a doctorate, to become Rabbi Dr. Bernard Raphael. Rabbi Belkin is overwhelmed, but he tells Rabbi Revel, and he's trying to find himself. This is 29. He's sitting in the Beis Medrash. He's learning. He has a chavruta. No, who can tell me who Reb Shmuel Belkin's chavruta was in the Rietz Beis Medrash in 29? Gentlemen, I know the man who wrote about it. He's an ear witness. It appears in a book called From Washington Avenue to Washington Street. The author of that book learned in Lakewood. The Mashgiach of Lakewood was Reb Nosson Wachvogel. Reb Aaron Cutler told Reb Nosson Wachvogel, I want that student to remain. Er hat a gute Kopf. Don't want to translate it. And Reb Nosson Wachvogel went after this young kid named Arnold Edward Rothkopf. And Reb Nosson told the young Rothkopf, I repeat, these ears heard it. He said, Ich hab gelernt mit Reb Shmuel Belkin. We were chavruta. I taught him English, and he taught me Gemara. You may quote me, all future generations, Reb Nosson Wachvogel, the Mashgiach of Lakewood, the older Mashgiach, the father of the famous Rabbi Wachvogel of today, who have put everyone into Cherem except the Satmarov, has somehow escaped their distaste. Reb Nosson told me, I repeat it again, Reb Shmuel Belkin taught me Gemara, and I taught him English. Yes, Rabbi Belkin realized right away, one has to learn English. It's America. Today in America, no one has to learn English. If you live in New York, you have to learn Spanish. If you live in Florida, you have to learn Spanish. If you live in Los Angeles, you have to learn Spanish. Eidut Nemana, the announcements in the airport, you can't understand one word. They're in Spanish and in broken accented English. You ride on a New York subway and you hear the announcements being made. It is impossible. First of all, it's not clear. The subway cars, the older ones, Manhattan Garnish. And even where you hear, the accent is such that a kid born in the Bronx can't understand the word. But in America in 1929, you had to know English. So Rabbi Belkin started mastering the dictionary. Went through a dictionary. By the way, my father-in-law did exactly the same thing. Went through a dictionary and learned word by word what the dictionary says, all the words. But that doesn't help you in conversational English. You can know all the dictionary words. You can read any book in the world. You can understand every five-syllable word there is. But Alan, how do you learn how to speak English? So in the yeshiva at that time, one of the hotshots, one of the stars, was a young man by the name of Emanuel Rachman. You've heard the name. This is the famous Rabbi Rachman, later Rabbi Emanuel Rachman of Shari Tfila Far Rockaway, and then right the fifth. Did he go to Fifth Avenue or Fifth Avenue? And then he went to Bar Ilan University. Wow, this is Rabbi Rachman. Rabbi Rachman arranged for Rabbi Belkin to take a course. Rabbi Rachman was studying. There was no yeshiva college yet. Well, Yeshiva College had just begun, September 28th, and Rabbi Rachman arranged for Rabbi Belkin to take a course in conversational English at Columbia University, where he was studying. So now you have Rabbi Belkin starting to pick up English. Okay, let's pause for 1 second. Yomo, Max Daniel, Jason Alan, that's the tall fellow sitting there, Houston, Texas, Baltimore, Maryland. What does it mean, Baltimore, Maryland? He went to Ne'er Yisrael, or he moved there? Houston, we have to... Rafi Klein. Rafi, very happy and proud to see you, because I don't like students who only take my Monday class, because they're going to walk away saying that Rakefet is a big amaretz, all he can do is tell stories and jokes. At least from the Sunday class, you can't say that as easily. Right or wrong? You got it. Thank you. Rafi Klein. Not Klein, Rafi Grois. That is your name. Nish Klein, Gross. Rafi Gross. Alex Glassman. Penn, what does Penn mean? U of P? U of P. I used to teach the students to have a picture, 1961, teaching Malcolm Holmlein, giving him a shear and some of his friends. You know who I'm talking about? Malcolm Holmlein, the head of the Jewish people in the United States, executive director of the President's Conference. Malcolm Holmlein, Philadelphia boy. But you are Upper West Side. You're not the U of P. You're not Pennsylvania. You're not Philadelphia. Right?
Yeah, I went to college there.
You went, I understand. You went to university there. Ora Watson, Queens College, Kew Gardens Hills. Wow. Kew Gardens Hills. Mark Watson. Dublin, San Diego, Teaneck, Beit Shemesh. What a story. You were born in Dublin? 1 second, so you're related to the Herzogs?
Not related,
but where's your accent?
Lost it when I went to California.
You lost it, how old were you when you went to California?
12.
12, okay. Alan Strauss, Far Rockaway. Alan, you were my student in the 80s, not in the 70s? Seems like a long time ago.
I was your student in 1983 and 1986.
83 and 86, awesome. That was only yesterday. Moshe Schwartz, fourth year. Morty Tarrigan, Vic Snow, Yitzchak Rubin. Is there anyone whose name I do not have? No. Okay, let us roll. Max Daniel, Jason Allen is not here. Rafi Klein. Rafi, now there's one problem. His cousin Ida Sobel can support him, but it's limited. He has to have a panasser. He has to go to work. It's America. It's not like America today with the food stamps. This is America of 1929. It's before the stock market crash. It's a different America. Ah, he has to go to work. Rafi, did you hear my lectures of last year? Were you listening on the website? Can anyone tell me what was perhaps one of the early out-of-town yeshiva? New Haven, Connecticut, Rabbi Yehuda Levenberg, right or wrong, we spoke about it last year. Rafi, Dr. Belkin is hired as a Ram, as a Reish Matifta, as a Rebbe in this yeshiva. That yeshiva you're looking at me, New Haven, Connecticut. Alex Glassman is wondering, what happened to the building? What happened to the glass? Where are the windows today? Who heard of a yeshiva in New Haven, right or wrong? That yeshiva didn't succeed in New Haven. It went on to Cleveland. It didn't succeed in Cleveland. But then it went on to Baltimore. And boy, did it succeed in Baltimore. Mark Neisrael owns the city today. Rambam Yeshiva had to close, lack of students. Nei Yisrael, its roots, Cleveland, and before Cleveland, New Haven, Connecticut. And one of the first Rebbeim in that yeshiva was Rav Shmuel Belkin. Now, all right, I have to tell you, Rabbi Belkin was so proud of the fact that he taught there that when I was working on my doctorate and writing my doctorate, so I showed him what I wrote about him, the biographical part, and he told me I must put in that he taught in New Haven. He was a Rebbe there, 29 to 1930. He was proud of it. And if you look at Revel, it's there. It's in the book. We have a book launch for Revel and Silver. The Sunday after Sukkot, I'm not going to be teaching my regular class, but I will be speaking at the Yoyu Center. The minute I have more details, I'll let you know. Okay. Now, Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Belkin, comes back to Rabbi Revel. Look what he looked like at that time. It's the early 30s. Young man, Gaon. Lady, you should know he sends papers to his mother, is able to bring it to America in 34. She goes to her daughter in Canada. About 6 months later, she comes to New York, or comes where Rabbi Belkin was living at the time, Rhode Island, and she remains with Rabbi Belkin until the day that she dies. Many years, many years. She dies in 1949. She was with him a good, make the cheshbon, a good 15 years. Remained with her son. He married. She remained part of the house. By the way, the Rav is the same story. His wife's mother lived with them until the day she died. Levitt, Mrs. Levitt, the Rebbetzin's mother, lived with them until the day she died. Very fascinating. There are many similarities between them, and not only similarities, but their outlooks. Rabbi Belkin and the Rav outlooks, very similar, yet different. It's fascinating. We'll get to it. Now, he's starting to become an American. And here, Rabbi Vic Geller is very, very, I would say, sensitive. Samuel Belkin did not merely come to America. I'm quoting from page 58. He embraced it. In contrast to the cruel coarse life in Europe, it was hopeful and refined. He was driven to become westernized. With the financial help of his cousin, he quickly adopted modern dress. A 1930 photo reveals a young man dressed in a dapper suit and wearing a stylish gray fedora. But not just the clothes. He now decides he has to have a university education. He has to have a doctorate. He's following the example of Rabbi Revel. Comes back to the yeshiva. Talks with Rabbi Revel. Rabbi Revel goes to work and uses his contacts. And Rabbi Belkin is accepted into Brown University. He is a person who never even had a high school education. He knew Shas and Poskim. Anything he knew beyond that was autodidactic. And Rabbi Revel came up with a whole report on him. Rabbi Vic Geller reproduces it where they mentioned the classes he took at Dreetz and who he studied with at Dreetz and Reb Shimon Shkop and Talmud and Poskim. I mean, all this Rabbi Belkin knew. And Brown University accepts him. Not only do they accept him, the question of Schar Limud comes up, needs a scholarship, tuition. He wants to study the humanities. Belkin was told that the scholarships available at Brown in the field of study were restricted to Baptist ministers. The sympathetic officer struggled to find a way to justify making an exception. He thought for a while, and then he announced to Rabbi Belkin, quote, "You may not be a Baptist, but you are surely a minister. I hereby declare you to be an honorary Baptist minister," end quote. And that's how Rabbi Belkin got a scholarship to Brown. While at Brown, he takes courses at Harvard. The courses at Harvard, they send the transcript to Brown University, A+. A+. Revel was the living embodiment of Belkin's dreams. This was a role model. This Talmud student, prototype of a son, is emulating Rabbi Revel right down the line. PhD, knowledge. While all this is going on, Reb Shimon Shkop goes back to Europe. Rabbi Belkin was very close to Reb Shimon Shkop, which leads us to conclude, and again, it's so hard to prove this, Rabbi Belkin arrived in America at the age of 17, 1911, 1928, 17 years of age. He arrives at Dreetz half a year later, so let's say he's 18 years of age. Where could he have studied in Europe? Slonim. How did he know Reb Shimon Shkop? Reb Shimon Shkop was the Grodno Rosh Yeshiva. Alex, how did he know him? And yet they knew each other intimately, which leads us to conclude that Dr. Belkin also studied at Shaarei Torah in Grodno. And I know that Dr. Belkin knew Reb Shimon Shkop intimately. I know that from Dr. Belkin. But Figela tells a story, and he gives you the documentation who he heard it from, Henoch Cohen, who I yet knew. This was the YU hotshots of that period. None of them, unfortunately, are alive. When Reb Shimon is ordered back to Europe, remember I told you last week, Reb Shimon Shkop, everyone argues, why did he leave and the arts world, world has a field day? He was unhappy at YU and Alishkatsam at YU and Uptown at YU and a college at YU, and all that is absolutely not correct. Reb Zelig Epstein, his grandson, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, you understand, was a different personality. In this scandal with Reb Nosson Kamenetsky, there's the famous letter that Reb Zelig Epstein wrote to Rav Yoshev, and Reb Zelig Epstein's English had become native when he came over from Shanghai, when he came over running away from Hitler. He wound up in Canada, in Toronto, and he went to York University, got a bachelor's, got a master's. He was a physicist, and his English was as good as his Yiddish already. And he said, I read the entire two volumes, and there's nothing in there that you can object to. And that letter was never shown to Rabbi Yashev. You understand what we're dealing with in today's world? God have mercy on us. God have mercy. We're so distant from Torah. At least I hope in YU there's Torah. Torah Hashem Tamima, real Torah, real Yirat Shemayim. I hope, I don't know, I can only talk about my classroom. I hope. So, Reb Shimon was very upset that, Rabbi Belkin was very upset that his Rebbe Rebbe, he had to have to learn Grodno, was going back. It couldn't just be from America, from a brief encounter that he had such a deep relationship with Rav Shimon Shkop. He was very upset. So the story is told by eyewitnesses that when Rav Shimon sailed back to Europe, because he was ordered back, his yeshiva was falling apart, Rabbi Belkin accompanied his Rebbe along with other students to the train at Penn Station, because the boat was sailing from Boston Harbor, and he had to take the train. Rav Shimon had to go from New York to Boston. And they described the scene that Rav Shimon gets on the train and Rabbi Belkin is in tears, waving to his Rebbe. And Rav Shimon saw how ibegerasht, I have to say it in Yiddish, I don't know how to say it in English, ibegerasht, how overwhelmed his Talmud was. Rav Shimon came back to the door of the train and said to Rav Shmuel Belkin, let me give you the exact quote, Shmuel, it's vetzain all right. It will be all right. Don't worry. So you see, here is Rav Shimon going back. Here is Rabbi Belkin. Here is Rabbi Revel, who is of such aid to him, and he goes on to Brown, he goes on to conquer the world, PhD, brilliant thesis on Philo, published later by Harvard, and by 1935, he is already Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin. His average in college, A+. Genius. Photographic memory. During this period, and this is quite important, he becomes very close to the Rav. Becomes very close to the Rav. He lives in Rhode Island. Brown University is in Rhode Island. I believe it's in Providence, and the Rav is a train ride away, Boston, Massachusetts. Belkin is not married. He's single. Shabbos, you don't want to be alone. A lot has been written about this problem of Torah is oriented around the family situation. And people who are alone have a big problem. Shabbos, Yontif, Pesach Seder, who wants to make a Seder alone? It's a big problem. A lot has been discussed. I know with the Rav, we have on tape, actually, where he's addressing social workers, Rafi, in the mid-70s. And they're asking him questions. They're shooting questions at him. And one of the most fascinating questions from social workers, you make a Seder for people who are in a senior citizens, they're invited to homes. The only way they can get there is someone driving and taking them. These are people who are not Shomer Shabbos. Are you allowed to invite them? And I have to tell you, the Rav can't give a black and white answer. And the people asking the question say, and you know, Rebbe, the difficulty an older person has when they're all alone, Leil HaSeder. We are oriented around family. If you read the magazines today, Mishpacha, Ami magazine, I don't advocate reading them for their hashkafa. Ami is really way out as far as I can see. Mishpacha makes an attempt at least to try to understand the beautiful world that I come from and live in, the beautiful world that I'm part of. They make an attempt at least. But they have so many articles about these social problems, people alone. It's an interesting question. I'll deal with it down the line, not in the context of this class, but in the Sunday class when I deal with Rabbi Menashe Klein. Wow, you have to be proud, Rafi, to have the name Klein. And why is it Glassman? Glass can be broken. Ironman. Alex Ironman. Beautiful name. Jason, we met the first time Remember what I told you about Mel Allen? Gedenks, gentlemen, no more. Do you remember Mel Allen, the announcer for the Yankees? Vic, do you remember or not? Going, going, gone. You know what his real name was? Mel Israel. His father was a chazan in a shul down south. Could you imagine? The voice of the Yankees got the voice from his father doing chazaras hashatz. And was Mel Allen had gevleist from Yiddishkeit? He never married. I don't know what he knew from Yiddishkeit. At least today, they say on Susan Waldman, she fasts on Yom Kippur. So Baruch Hashem, I'm proud to hear her voice when she's interviewing the lowlifes of the New York Yankees. That's a different story. Jason, Eich Naflu Giborim, back here. Jason? So, Dr. Belkin would spend many a Shabbat in Boston. The Rebbetzin was very fond of him. She appreciated Dr. Belkin, a Litvisha. She was from Vilna. Rebbetzin Tanya Levitt, Soloveitchik. She had a mind too, you understand. You don't raise children like Atara and like Tova and like Chaim without the parents that both have great minds. She appreciated Dr. Belkin very much. The family tells me this. And he had a kinship with them. This becomes very important for the 40s, the 50s, into the 60s, as you will see. Well, Dr. Belkin needs a little money, spending money. He has a scholarship. The Rav had in Boston a post-bar mitzvah Talmud Torah program. Torah, I write about it, and you'll look into Revel, you'll see what I'm talking about. I can spend hours on it, but I can't do it now. It involves the yeshiva, the attempt to have a kollel in Boston, the branch of Reitz. It's all history. But thank God I've published it, so it's there. It's not lost. What I'm doing now, if I don't get it out of me, it'll be lost. So Dr. Belkin had this... the Rav had this post-high school Talmud. And what was the Talmud Torah? Today, it's gone. You don't see it anymore in the Torah world. When I was growing up, every kid in yeshiva, when we finished college and we wanted to get married, we all taught in Talmud Torahs. As a matter of fact, Sunday morning, if you walked into Reitz, there was no one in the Beis Medrash. Anyone above 21 was out. You were teaching. What were the Talmud Torahs? And by the way, some of the kids I taught, a few became religious. I don't want to put it down. A few became religious. I've met Talmud Torah. I had a student in the Kola. I met his father. I said, how do you come to Yiddishkeit, father? I said to the father, you're a Baal Tshuv. He says, I'm not a Baal Tshuv. He says, I went to Talmud Torah. I hung out near the rabbi. I never missed the davening Shabbos. He says, my wife, the tzaddeket, she's taka tzaddeket. She's a Baal Tshuv. How'd he meet his wife? His grandfather died, and his mother was sitting shiva. His mother taught, and this young teacher came in and started to teach. So she came, Lenachem Avol, her colleague. This kid who later sits with me in this kollel, I was Masad Kedushin for him, came Lenachem Avol, his mother. His mother says to her son, this is the girl you will marry. And that's the girl he married. And she became a Baal Tshuva, but a Baal Tshuva tzaddikin. He said, I'm not a Baal Tshuva. I'm not tzaycha to be a Baal Tshuva. Mokam shebaal tshuva omein. I'm not tzaycha. My wife, he was a Talmud Torah product. So Talmud Torah met. I made a living. I had to get married. So I started teaching in 59 in Avat Torah in Englewood, 3 days a week, Sunday and 2 afternoons. The year afterwards I was married. I needed more money. So I just, Talmud Steve Gross just gave me a book on the old Bronx where Malta and I grew up. I just gave it to my daughter. She Taka wants to read it. So I'll give it to all my daughters. So they mentioned Concourse Center in the book. There's even a picture. I taught Talmud Torah, Concourse Center. I ran the Shabbos morning youth meeting for the Talmud Torah kids. That was a Talmud Torah. But then you had a terrible problem. The kid, Jason, he's bar mitzvahed. Goodbye with Yiddishkeit. Goodbye with study. He's the Gadol Ador already. He knows how to say Shema Yisrael. He knows how to say Kaddish. You know the old story that this kid starts Talmud Torah at the age of 7 and the Rebbe starts teaching him Kaddish. The father comes running. yelling and shouting in Yiddish at the Rebbe. I'll say it in English. What are you teaching him? Kaddish, I'm still alive. And he says, don't worry. By the time your son learns how to say Kaddish, it'll be 120 years from now. You follow me, Rafi? So Max, Talmud Torah. But the Rav had post Bar Mitzvah, a high school program. And in that high school program, they even learned Talmud. Who taught for the Rav? Who taught the highest class? Who taught Gemara? Reb Shmuel Beltin. That was his second teaching job in America. And here you have the classic story of that rabbi. I'm giving Vigela Smicha, Dr. Gali, I've never heard doctor from Yeshiva. Vigela tells the story. I heard it directly from Rabbi Jimmy James Gordon, Zichrono Levracha. Jimmy Gordon. Again, anyone here from Detroit? Rabbi in Detroit many years, was told he had heart trouble, that he would only live another few years. He came in Aliyah and he lived in Israel about another 30 years after they told him, you have only 2 years left to live. So Jimmy Gordon was from the Boston area. His father, I believe, was a shaykhid, was a clay kodesh. His uncle was Lam Sheresh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Gordon. Jimmy Gordon was growing up before Maimonides was organized. He went to the Rav's post Bar Mitzvah Talmud Torah. Rabbi Belkin was his rabbi. And Jimmy Gordon tells the story that all these kids were from Yiddish-speaking homes, but the kids all grew up in America on the streets of Boston, and they all spoke perfect English. You all know you can be from a Hebrew-speaking home, but if you're living in New York, you're going to speak perfect English as well. They were very unhappy with Rav Shmuel Belkin because his English was heavily accented. So they started complaining, why does he teach in English? Let him teach in Yiddish. They knew both languages. They were just as happy to hear him in Yiddish. And they started complaining to Dr. Belkin. Dr. Belkin went to the Rav. And the Rav walked into class. Vic Geller tells it, but I heard it directly from Jimmy Gordon. He heard it from Jimmy Gordon too. The Rav walks into class, and the Rav's English, which was less accented than Dr. Belkin. What do I hear? Does anyone have a complaint against Rabbi Belkin teaching in English? I want him to teach in English. It's a complaint to me. Does anyone have a complaint to me? And they were sitting there shaking. No one said a word. And Rav Shmuel continued to teach in English. Now, can anyone here tell me why the Rav was so makpid to have the Gemara taught in English? Very simple. Because the Rav knew there were always going to be some kids that he wants to attract from American homes who don't know a word of Yiddish. Why should it be closed to them? And ultimately, what happened in Boston in the mid-30s, early 30s, happened in YU in 1960. That's when Danny Greer came over to the Rav. And a guy named Rothkopf is sitting right there. He doesn't... The Rav is here. Rothkopf is there. Danny Greer is standing here. It's after Shir. And Danny Greer says to the Rav, I say it again and again and again because I'm an ear witness. This is living history. Totally honest. I'm not making up one syllable. He says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you're denying Jewish young men the chance to learn Gemara on a high level with you. And the Rav, what do you mean? I didn't know that Danny Greer's family knew the Rav. I didn't know they knew him. I knew Danny Greer. I didn't know his relationship, his father's relationship with the Rav. They were Egyptian Jews in the diamond business, and they were active in Moriah, but they didn't speak Yiddish. And Danny Greer says, Rebbe, I just graduated Princeton, and I don't speak Yiddish. I don't understand Yiddish. And at that moment, Torah came to an end in the history of YU. The Rav said, good, tomorrow Shir, that's Wednesday, this was Tuesday, will be in English, and I'll give you a Bechiner after the Shir. And the next day, Wednesday morning, 9 o'clock, whatever, 9:30, when Shir began, it began totally in English. And boy, were we sitting there and sweating, trying to follow the Rav's English. He never went back to Yiddish again. At that moment, Torah came to an end in the United States. But it goes back to Boston. Unbelievable. The Rav walked in, and this was their relationship. Okay. Now, 1935, never has this happened in the history of yeshiva. First time ever. 35, Rabbi Belkin is appointed instructor of Greek and Latin. Okay? Could you imagine? Here's a kid, came to America, could barely speak English, becomes a teacher in the college. 1936, he is appointed a Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva. 35, 36. 1937, something revolutionary happens in the Yeshiva. I've lectured on it extensively. I'll just have to be very brief now. A graduate division in Semitic studies is organized. Jason, you know it today as the Bernard Revel Graduate School, correct? Then it was just called the Graduate Division. Max, Rabbi Belkin is appointed the director, which in your language means the dean of the new graduate school. Why does yeshiva suddenly have a graduate school? And this you have to understand, there are two different approaches of how to learn Shas and Poskim. One approach is the traditional classic approach that we have in the yeshiva world, that is part of YU and part of Lakewood and part of Panovich and part of Porat Yosef and the Sfadic world. And we may have differences of nuance, but our learning is traditional. There's a scientific approach where you have Chochmat Yisrael Wissenschaft. It's very different. The seminary was attracting a lot of yeshiva college students. Many students, this went on in the 30s, into the 40s, into the 50s, even the early 60s. It won't happen today. Today, just the opposite. You have graduates of the seminary who become true B'nai Torah. Some of them sat in this very classroom. But then the seminary was technically a school committed to halacha, and they had a scientific approach, and they had Professor Louis Ginsberg. Louis Ginsberg, and we spoke about him in detail, was it last year, 2 years ago, I don't remember, 3 years ago, Louis Ginsberg was a Telza yeshiva student, a gon adir. And he had the scientific approach. I can't go into more detail now. With Bible, with Talmud, with Midrash, with Yerushalmi. And it was attractive. Louis Ginsberg was Louis Ginsberg. You all saw what Professor Mark Shapiro published, the letters Reb Moshe Soloveitchik to him, Reb Yitzchak Kutner to Louis Ginsberg, with such derech eretz. And evidently Rabbi Belkin and Rabbi Revel felt the yeshiva had to do something. And they opened up a graduate school. And Rabbi Belkin, take a look. Here's a person who a few years ago couldn't speak English. He's now a Rebbe in the yeshiva. He's now a teacher in the college. In 1940, he's promoted to full professor by Rabbi Revel. He's now the director of the graduate school. And he remains the same seemingly quiet, lovable Reb Shmuel Belkin. I can tell you, I was told by many students of Reb Shmuel Belkin in these golden years, 36 and 37 and 38 and 39 and 40 and 41, 42, 43, 44, through 45, the students claim he was the most beloved Rebbe in the history of the yeshiva. He was approachable. He was someone you idolized. He combined all the worlds that the YU students dreamed about at that time. I don't know today what the dreams are. I don't think they're the same. But a kid in the 30s into the 40s, here is a man, a PhD. A book published by Harvard University Press. Here is a man who has lived in Lithuania, a Litvish Talmud Chacham, who has successfully embraced the general world. Not only that, he was Phi Beta Kappa. And Vigela, there's one line in this book that is fabulous. He says Rabbi Belkin wore his Phi Beta Kappa key at all, you know, serious functions. He wore his Phi Beta Kappa key as a secular mezuzah. Quote, end quote. Secular mezuzah. Think about that. And these were the kids in YU. This was the dream. This is America. And here is a man who embodies everything that Moshe Schwartz of the 1930s dreamt about. They loved him as a Rebbe. They loved him as a professor. And he was very, very approachable. He opened his heart, his home, got married. Married the right girl. The girl who could help him. Rabbi Leventhal's granddaughter. Rabbi Bernard Leventhal was of the most important Agudat HaRabbanim rabbi in America. And as every biography and every scholar and every historian says about this period, he was the most Americanized of the Europäische Rabbanim. And Rabbi Leventhal made Rabbi Revel president. He played a role in making Rabbi Belkin president. His son-in-law, Hyman Ehrlich, was a businessman. Rabbi Revel married the Ehrlich girl, the granddaughter. It was the granddaughter of Rabbi Leventhal. So on all sides, the students looked up to him. And they described when you came to Rabbi Belkin's home, you were his guest for Shabbos. Students walked in. Their Rebbe's guest, he took their coats off. So they asked Reb Shmuel, this is eyewitnesses related this, they said to Reb Shmuel Belkin, you are the Rebbe, you are the Rosh Yeshiva. How come you're taking your students' coats off? And you know what he answered? When a student takes off his own coat, there's no mitzvah involved. When I take off my student's coat, it's a gemilat chesed. I build up a mitzvah. That's what he answered. He was a goymel chesed. This was Rabbi Belkin, as we will see. He was power. He was Flintstone. No one realized it. The outer veneer was modest, seemingly unassuming. Not a powerful speaker. Rabbi Belkin? Not like the Rav. The Rav, when he spoke Yiddish, could move mountains, could shake the world. When the Rav spoke Yiddish, thousands listened to him in awe 4.5 hours. You cried, you laughed, you jumped, you danced. Spoke English afterwards also. Wasn't like Yiddish, but certainly was way beyond the English that Vic Snow and yours truly speak. They used to say about the Rav, he made Abba Eben look second rate. A lot of truth to it. Rabbi Belkin couldn't speak English to move, couldn't speak Yiddish to move you. It's like there were marbles in his mouth. You'd hear him speak, he didn't make any effort. but he moved mountains. His sincerity, his drive, his vision. Wow. He was Flintstone. But you didn't realize it. You didn't recognize it. So here's a man achieving beyond anyone's wildest dreams. Speaking English. Barely in America 10 years. Full professor. Director of the graduate school. Beloved Rebbe. Teacher of Greek, Latin. Publisher of his doctorate. Publisher Plato, Philonian, Philo, I should say. What a doctorate, what a publication. Caused a lot of reaction, wasn't accepted in many circles. He turns Philo, who many Torah scholars had claimed he was not within the traditional fold, that he had innovated, and Rabbi Belkin came along and showed that Philo was part and parcel of the Torah tradition, and he explained any innovation as being based upon authentic sources. Later, posthumously, from his notes and some articles he wrote, more work was published in the name of Rabbi Belkin on Philo and his Perushim on Chumash. But this was Rabbi Belkin. But what can I say? A young man has an ego, has a drive, wants to achieve. Rabbi Revel is gone. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik is gone. If someone would have said to you in 1941 when all this was happening, or late 40, early 41, you know who the next president of Yeshiva is going to be? Reb Shmuel Belkin. You would have laughed in his face. You would say, what, are you crazy? That's like telling me Rakefet is going to hit in 57 straight games like Joe DiMaggio. One game more. What are you? Don't know what you're talking about. You're out of the ballpark. Who heard of him? Who are we talking about? Rabbi Young, Rabbi Soloveitchik, even Rabbi Luchstein, Rabbi Belkin, Nechbal HaKelim, professor of Greek and Latin, a Rebbe in the yeshiva, director of a little graduate school program. Big deal. Don't mention his name to me. He doesn't stand a chance. And boy, anyone who thought that, and there were many, did they turn out to be wrong, as we will see. So my dear students, Alex Ironman, and Rafi Gross. Wow. What did we do today? We introduced you to Reb Shmuel Belkin. As I said, we lack so many facts about his life. Where did he learn? One thing we can be sure, Slonim and Grodno. Somehow Vic Geller claims he also learned in Rotten, and there seems to be a connection to Rotten, and he did know the Chafetz Chaim, and we know there's a connection because he brought his Rebbe from Rotten to YU, Reb Menachem Mendel Sachs, the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law, from the Upper West Side. So he did learn in Rotten too. It's hard to understand in such a short period of time. Let's say he began when he was 13, Slonim, Grodno, Rotten. But we don't know for sure, we don't know the years, we only know his relationship with Reb Mendel Sachs, with Reb Shimon Shkop, and with Rabbi Rum, who was a very Reb Shimon Rum, Reb Shimon Vesaka, he was a big Gilui later when he went to Mir. We all knew him, but the facts, but it seems that what I just said now is correct. As far as coming in, Ida Sobel, the support, his sister, mechanic, Rose Mechanic, Canada, Torah Vedas, Reitz, New Haven, Rabbi Revel, how he got him into Brown University, Harvard, honorary Baptist minister. All that seems to be absolutely correct. So this is a little framework before we come into the heart of Rabbi Belkin's life. My dear students, I wouldn't miss Sunday's class for all the hummus that is being sold in the state of Israel, along with the honey, before Rosh Hashanah. Wow. Sunday we pick up just where we left off, Reb Menashe Klein, and then we come to Reb Moshe Bick, then we come to the most fascinating document I can show you, which I knew nothing about 1 year ago. Rafi, can you tell me why? The book wasn't published yet. Mesoret Moshe, Reb Moshe and the Chazon Ish, that's the heart of Sunday. Yeah. Yitzchak, you're going to be shaking. And then we go on to the terror tactics recorded for posterity. The first time ever. If that Talmud who asked me the question of Alon Shvut and Haaretz Zion is listening, you asked me, is it true about the Satmarav? My educated guess is absolutely, because wait till you hear what Reb Menashe Klein records. And then we continue to sail into London and why they killed each other over the Arab. Please pass this back to Yitzchak, Reb Asher Weiss. I have just entered into the Beis Medrash, the second volume of the Minchat Asher, Shele Tuchivet Reb Asher Weiss, on Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, including a tshuva to Reb Heschel Shechter. You will find it very interesting, including a tshuva to Reb Aryeh Frimmer, who's also a Yeshiva College graduate. Gentlemen, I just want to tell you about a sefer that I highly recommend. Those of you who read modern Hebrew, Derech Acheret by Chagai Ben Artzi. Chagai Ben Artzi is the Prime Minister's brother-in-law, Sarah's younger brother. Sarah Netanyahu's younger brother. Her father, his father, was the last living Talmud of the Alter of Nevadak, Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz. It is this volume. It's about the father, how he throws away religion and he becomes a Zionist, and that's going to solve all problems. And what happens in his life and how he comes back, b'lev v'nefesh. It's a fabulous volume. It's very easy to read. It's not a detailed volume. It's not the volumes that I've been going through that are 700 pages, 600 pages, the ones on the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But it's a very easy read. But if you want to understand this generation's soul, this is the volume. Wow. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed it. If anyone wants a calendar, I have two calendars here. Anyone needs a calendar for the new year, you're welcome to it. And finally, I see there's more than finally. This is about Lakewood. Well, we spoke about last year about Lakewood and how it began and what went on in Lakewood. It's a very interesting, and Rabbi Tendler, we spoke about Rabbi, what was his name, Yosef Tendler, am I right, from Baltimore, who died, Rabbi Shalom Tendler, give me the right name, I'm confusing, Yosef, right, the brother, yeah, it's about when Yosef Tendler said, Eidut Nemana, that when Rabbi Aaron first came to Lakewood, there was no Chal of Yisrael, they used Breakstone's products, and how a kid reading this today said it's impossible. Rabbi Tendler can't be telling the truth. Rabbi Aaron Cutler would use Breakstone products. And here there's a whole Talmud Isaac Kurtz sent this to me. Very fascinating. It came last June after class ended here with the whole machlokot, which I remember that Lakewood was buying Chol of Yisrael from the Bnei Akiva Farm, Bachad, in New Jersey, which was near Lakewood, And the whole machloket in Lakewood, are you allowed to drink, as this Kol of Yisrael from the Mizrahi? Yankel Schiff will nicht trinken Milch from the Mizrahi. And Rabbi Aaron replied, if the milk is mutter, megen trinken a filu from the Shein Machatzaia. It's a very interesting article. And I lived it, I remember it, and here it comes back to life. Finally, if there's anyone here who's a Yankee fan, the Talmud sent this to me, I enjoyed it, but we got to pass it on. It's about Derek Jeter, who may be the last Yankee player ever in history, because all of baseball has changed today. There's no concept of a team. It's a concept of hiring movie stars to put out a movie. If you're interested, it's all the great moments in Derek Jeter's life. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. Thank you very, very much.